Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Good evening, everybody. Jacob Daniel here. This is the Daniel 3 podcast. Thanks for tuning in tonight. Running a little late. I had to work today. My wife's gone on a women's retreat. And so I had the kids at my mom's house and then had to run, pick them up, get them back here, get them to sleep. I'm still in my work clothes, but I'm just like, yeah, screw it. Whatever. Doesn't really matter. Got a lot of stuff to talk about tonight with our guest. First, we'll do the basic housekeeping. Of course, as always, as with most episodes, I plug my good friend Will Bell's Rabbit Eye Blueberry Wine. If Jesus was walking the earth today, still turning water into wine, I would hope that he'd be doing blueberry wine because that's what's up. And my guest tonight, actually, him and I might... I think we had enough of this for maybe, a while, probably till the next communion, because we both drank too much of it last night. But he is Liam McCollum. We met on from Doing Reed's show, fellow libertarian Christian and Meacock, has his own show, does really great deep dives into foreign policy and other current events and stuff. And we're going to have a conversation tonight about some stuff that he's been doing over there in his home state of Montana and on just kind of broadly speaking, what we do as Christian libertarians to try to, appeal to our folk, I guess. So I'm going to bring him up now. Liam, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. And I totally agree with you. Probably won't be drinking that wine for a while, but I do recommend that everyone go check out his wine, though, Will's wine. It's really good stuff. I drank a whole bottle last night. Probably
yeah. Bad idea. Yeah, you definitely downed a whole lot. By the way, your internet, okay, maybe it's shaken up now. You were frozen up a little bit there. I don't know if you want to try leaving and coming back in, because that seems to fix it last night.
You can do that, because I had the same problem last night.
Yeah. All right, so we'll give Liam a chance to leave and rejoin. Also, while we're waiting for him, I'll say that I'm still working on getting my website back up. it's a bit of a mess with the hosting process, but the website will be back up soon. Something glitched out when we switched from one host to another, and it should hopefully be fixed soon. All right, there you go. Now you're normal and not like in the weird matrix zone that you were.
Yeah, I can't tell when it happens on my end, so you should let me know if it happens.
Well, again. What's weird is that it didn't do anything until we went live. Like, you were fine in the back room beforehand, and then we went live, and then it just kind of all went to hell. But
and then
whatever.
Last night, nothing happened until I started talking. And
right.
It just
yeah.
Froze up. Whatever.
So, yeah, but yeah, I mean, long time no talk, right? It's only been 24 hours, so how you doing?
Less than that. I'm doing really well. Tired today, but we stayed up until like midnight here talking afterwards, which was a lot of fun. It's good to catch up with you guys.
Yeah, no, that was one of our, I don't know. I think like each talk gets a little bit better, but yeah, that was definitely a fun conversation. And then the conversation got really good afterward, because we talked for like 2 hours after we were done streaming, which I was telling Reed, because I was looking at Reed's Patreon the other day, and I was like, dude, like, you have like nothing there. Like, there's no tiers, there's no content. It's just like, which, I mean, it's on brand for him, I guess. He's just like, hi, I'm Reed. Like, you know, I do a show, give me money. It's just like, you got to put something there. Like, you know, those kind of after hours stuff might be something he might want to consider doing.
Yeah, that would definitely be interesting with the Four Horsemen.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, so this is, we've talked a bunch, but this is your first time on my show. So, maybe we'll just start out just briefly, let you introduce yourself, and just kind of your background and stuff for my listeners who might not catch you on Reed's show.
Yeah, I'm a student here at the University of Montana. I grew up here in Montana, and my story as to how I came to libertarianism is pretty unconventional. A lot of people came through Ron Paul, the 2008 campaign, but I was 8 years old, so I was way too young. My parents watched the debates, and I think they supported Romney. So I grew up in a pretty traditional conservative household, and I was a neocon up until my senior year of high school. And then I signed up for a civics class where my teacher was actually an anarchist libertarian who liked Ron Paul.
Wow.
And I mean, that, you know, not a lot of people take a civics class, let alone have an anarchist teacher teaching them, you know? So I'm very lucky in that respect. And he wasn't very overt with his beliefs or anything, but I eventually caught on, and then we started to have more conversations. I would stay after, and I would ask questions about the Constitution, and eventually that led me to Lysander Spooner. And I found that there were a lot of contradictions, because on one hand, he seemed to support some things that Donald Trump would do. But then all of a sudden out of nowhere, he would be bashing like Obamacare or something like that. And me at the time, I'm a very binary thinker. I'm supporting MAGA, had a MAGA hat and everything. And then every once in a while, he'd just start to bash Trump on foreign policy. And I think that kind of broke the whole, you know, binary system that I was in. And I was like, wait, you can actually be nuanced in your beliefs here. You don't have to like belong to one camp.
But was part of it just that they were offering like a legit criticism of Trump and not like all the deranged crap that you hear from like the media and the left? Because I know, yeah, that's because I know that's something that, now I came from the left, but I had a weird experience where I hated Trump, and that's kind of why I voted for Hillary when I was on the left still and a registered Democrat. But then I could tell the media was being dishonest about him for like his first year. And then the first people who were actually criticizing him in the way that lined up with what my problems were libertarians. And so that's kind of why I started to be attracted to them.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. I mean, like, I think it's pretty sad that the left, at least like the establishment, really put libertarians in a position where they felt like they needed to defend Trump at times. Or like even leftists like Glenn Greenwald, the fact that like, they were so dumb in how they treated Trump that we were in the position of defending him a lot. But yeah, no, I think the predominant reason was foreign policy, though. And it was very theoretical. I wasn't really technical in my political beliefs. Like, I didn't know much about foreign policy and what we were doing in Afghanistan or Iraq or Yemen or anything like that. But it was more on the level of like, well, I had been given these narratives that conservatives were in favor of limited government and natural rights and all of these things. And then it seemed to be very inconsistent policy. I think I just froze for a second. Am I back?
You're back now. You're good.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So they were very inconsistent in their foreign policy, specifically when Trump first bombed Syria and then dropped the Moab a week later. Those things really woke me up, because I started to look into like, Trump's cabinet, and I know that he was very relaxed in his foreign policy and kind of gave generals, his generals, really the freedom to do whatever. a big example is that like Trump didn't even know about the MOAB until after it was dropped on Afghanistan. And I think that really woke me up to the military industrial complex. And most of it was through foreign policy.
Well, yeah, that's super interesting. So when did you get involved in the LP and you're in the state of Montana? Like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, so I got involved shortly before. So I got involved when Tom Woods and people that I had been listening to for a while started to endorse Jacob Hornberger. And I got involved with my convention, and it was pretty small at the time. Like, I think only 10 people showed up. I just showed up and I decided to become an alternate for the convention that year. So I actually voted for Hornberger and I went to that convention. And then after Hornberger lost and Jorgensen got nominated, I actually supported her for a little bit just because I was like, well, I'm in the Libertarian Party. I might as well support the candidate. And then obviously there were the mistakes that happened with the Twitter account and then not really paying attention to COVID.
Although those mistakes seem very benign compared to some of her more recent missteps.
Oh, yeah, seriously. Because I was watching that episode live with, what's his name, Patrick?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was watching that episode live, and when she said that about Dave, the 12 shots in, I was like, are you serious? And well, I think that really woke me up to, like, I don't think she's really in control of her campaign. I think that there are just people who are active on social media who are kind of like telling her things.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I believe the anti-racism tweet is probably along the same lines too. But yeah.
Yeah. But it's also, sad. It's one thing to let somebody put out a bad tweet on your social media campaign or your social media account. And I honestly defended her longer than most in my camp, in our camp, you know what I mean? And it wasn't because I was especially impressed by her, although I did like Spike, obviously, but I just kind of felt like, okay, but she's got her issues, but she's a lot better than Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, and we should, unless, like, if somebody is just maybe not running the best campaign but they're still good on the issues, we should still support them even if we would have preferred somebody else. And that was kind of my attitude for a while. But that interview with Patrick, where she talked about Dave, was like a complete lack of situational awareness, and like it wasn't even just that part. Like, that whole interview was just such a cringe fest. And it's just, yeah, I mean, she's not a nice lady. I think her and I, you know, well, here, I'll answer my thoughts on Joe Jorgensen like she did about Dave. Like, you know, I'm sure on healthcare, you know, no difference, right? But, you know, she thinks that it's okay to strawman people and their beliefs based upon hearsay rather than, you know, actually talking to them and looking into them, or, you know, just, you know, saying pass when asked a question about something that you're not maybe the most comfortable answering. It's just, I don't know. It is what it is. But
I guess the benefit to that episode, though, is maybe that opens up the possibility Dave goes on there.
Maybe. That would be cool.
Because, I mean, everyone in the comments was saying that she's the reason why the Libertarian Party isn't, or, like, people like her are the reason that the Libertarian Party, or people leave it. And yeah. Then most people were endorsing Dave in the comments.
Yeah, no, hopefully he does, you know, especially down the road if he does end up seeking the nomination. I know he's gonna get on a lot of podcasts, and you know, especially like people like Pat or people like Dave Rubin. He already goes on Rogan and Tim Pool, so it's super exciting to see that possibility happen. So you guys in Montana recently had your convention, right? What happened there, and what is kind of like the Montana LP like right now? I mean, are you guys still on the smaller side? Is it kind of like one of these more contentious states, or does everybody get along? Like, what's kind of the backstory of the party leading up to the convention?
Yeah, I'd say there's not enough infrastructure and there's not really a party there for there to be much contention.
Okay.
So like the party has grown, it's doubled its size over the last 2 years, and that is attributed to the Mises Caucus. But as for active members, it's still really small, and it doesn't help that our state is so large. I mean, I had to drive 7 hours to get to the convention that happened last month, so, or a couple of weeks ago. And
is Montana mostly like mountain region and not populated, or is it?
It's so the western part of the state is very mountainous, but okay. The eastern side is like really flat and looks like Wyoming.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had to drive from Missoula to Miles City, and that took me 7 hours.
Damn.
Yeah. So that's part of the problem. I feel like if we really started to, if we had our conventions at like some place in the middle of the state, I feel like more people would be able to come. But the current chair wants to move us around every year.
That's what our party had been doing for a while. And I mean, in Pennsylvania is a little bit smaller than Montana, but it's still big enough that like they've done it. Like 1 year they did it in like as close to like the northeastern corner as they could. And then the next year it was in Pittsburgh. And I was just like, why don't we just do it like in Harrisburg or somewhere central where it's just, you know, yeah. It just doesn't make sense to like make some people drive 10 minutes and some people drive 5 hours or 6 hours to make a convention. It's a little, but so I mean, how big was it? Like, you know, like we're talking 50 people, 100
people?
Well, we
had 19 people show up to the convention.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty small. I mean, Miles City, though, is really tiny, so it makes sense.
My and county affiliate is bigger than your state party.
Yeah, the county I'm in has, like, 3 active people in it. So, and we're, like, one out of, I think, 7 counties that are affiliated.
Is Montana a blue or red state? Is it a red state because they're just mostly rural?
It was very purple until COVID.
Okay.
We had a blue governor for 8 years, and then COVID happened, and... Yeah, we for the first time I think in like 16 years we got a Republican governor, and we only have one member in our delegation to DC is a Democrat. So, And then the legislature in Montana is very red.
Gotcha. All right. So you guys got your I don't know what else you did in the state party, but one of the things that I saw that you told me and that you kind of put out there was that you guys made some changes to your, I guess, your platform. One of the changes being that you removed the abortion plank. Was that? I mean, there's only, you know, not many of you, but was it a contentious thing, or was it something that was pretty much, you know, went through without a problem?
Yeah. Well, the party and the people in the party say that they've been debating this plank for decades, since probably the party first began, and apparently it's come up every single convention, which happens on even years. That's the platform convention. And apparently people would introduce pro-life platforms, and then you would get like contentious debates about the language and just like what a specific term means in the current plank. And my position the whole time since I first joined the party was that we should get rid of the plank entirely to avoid those discussions and avoid the headache. Also, as a Mises Caucus organizer, one of the biggest roadblocks, I guess, to getting people into the party is the abortion plank. When I'm talking to conservatives, and specifically conservatives who are kind of disaffected Republicans right now, they say that they're willing to join the party, but the abortion plank, they can't sign on to it. And I'll read the current language or the language before this last convention, because I think it's kind of important to see why conservatives or more conservative leaning people would be opposed to it. So it was 1.5. It says, recognizing that abortion is a sensitive issue and that people can hold good faith views on all sides, we believe that government should be kept out of the matter, leaving the question to each person for their conscientious consideration. So to me, the way that it's read almost seems like it should say, recognizing that abortion is a sensitive issue and that people can hold good faith views on all sides, we do not speak on the matter, something like that. But instead, it seems to take more of a pro-choice stance by saying that government should be kept out of the matter. And then, you know, I would before I propose the amendment, I was just talking to people in the party, and one of the biggest arguments against it was that, like, you know, we believe in private societies and government should stay out of it or something like that. And I said, well, even if, you know, if we do believe in private societies, it's totally possible that a private society might prohibit abortion. I think instead of getting into those philosophical conversations about what the proper libertarian stance is, I think we should just avoid those debates every 2 years and really allow candidates to have that conversation at the door. Someone who argued in favor of it was like, you know, I can turn off people when I'm at the door. I don't need a website or the Libertarian Party platform to do that for me. And I think that that's a pretty good argument for that.
Yeah, no, it's similar. That language is similar to what the national platform is too. And yeah, it's sort of like, it pays a little bit of lip service to, like, there being different points of view, but then just basically ends up taking the other, you know, one side of the argument, which, and I know there's some, like, especially in the Praxian or post-lib or whatever they want to be called camp, that feel like, you know, they've told me, like, well, it's not enough to remove, you got to put in the pro-life plank. But I feel like, you know, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Sounds like we probably agree here. Like, as much as I'm personally pro-life, I don't view the Libertarian Party or even politics in general as being the vehicle to sort of combat the issue of abortion, other than, like, where it maybe is going to be sort of a tangential thing, like a tangential component to a broader issue, like, let's say, like ending welfare spending or cutting off funding to Planned Parenthood or, well, you know, things like that, that, like, there's a libertarian argument to be made beyond just the topic of abortion. You know, same with, like, what we talked about on Reed's show last night, like with decentralization and whatnot. Other than that, though, I just feel like abortion is not something that you can combat with the political system. And if you're going to be involved in politics, you know, especially within the Libertarian Party, I think the goal is to sort of, as the Mises Caucus kind of puts it out there, you know, focus on, you know, solving a sort of core foundational set of issues and attacking those and not adding too many wedge issues that people are divided on. Rather focus on, like, those issues that there's broad support for, regardless of where people are coming from, and they're not going to get, you know, they're going to be more productive because they're focusing on a smaller set of issues that they agree on rather than being distracted by those wedge ones. Would you agree with that? Or
I think the kind of populist strategy is very smart, and that's kind of what was motivating this. I was the one who brought this amendment to the floor, because when I first got in the party, this was one of the biggest concerns for me. I also didn't want to be associated really with a party that had this stance. And then many, including the teacher from high school who was a libertarian, refused to join the party because of this plank. And the way that I kind of view the party is kind of as, like, I think it was Michael Heiss who told me this argument. It's like there was the Dallas Accords that kind of acknowledged that the Libertarian Party is a big tent. And it was like the compromise between the minarchists and the anarchists. And it's like, we're not going to take a stance in either direction. And we're going to acknowledge that, you know, we can have good faith views in both directions. And one of the arguments to get rid of the plank, I think, is that getting rid of it actually does what the plank is trying to do in spirit. It says, like, everyone can have good faith views on all sides. And we believe that everyone should leave it to their conscientious consideration. But I think actually removing it did that, right? It actually allows candidates, it allows members to hold their own view on it. And I actually, one of the proposals was to get rid of the abortion plank completely, but then leave in brackets 1.5 removed. And because I'm so opposed to like in either direction, because I'm opposed to taking a stance in either direction, I thought that if we left 1.5 brackets removed, that would draw attention to the fact that we removed it and might make a statement in the other direction. And I was like, rather than drawing attention to the issue at all, we should just remove it and then allow candidates or counties to create right. their own platforms.
Yeah.
And I think that that will overall benefit the party in the long term. Because I know the more blue county in the state, the one that I live in, Missoula County, was, I believe, the only county that won, that voted for Ron Paul in 2008 or 2012. Hmm. So the blue county here, you know, they might be more pro-choice or something like that, and we should allow for localism in that realm. But then also like the rest of the state leans red. And I'm like, why would we shoot ourselves in the foot when like people are so tired of the Republican Party right now? I hear it all the time. But ahead of time, we're going to say that, and we're going to ostracize these people who are more likely pro-life. I just think that it's not a great strategy. And a lot of people wanted to argue on philosophical grounds during this, while we were debating this amendment. And I was like, I'm not making a philosophical argument right now. Like we could talk about the nuances of, you know, what a libertarian society might do, what due process would look like if we were to, you know, prohibit abortion or something like that. And I'm like, that's not the purpose of the party, I don't think. Like, I think we should talk about the issues that we all agree on, because I mean, the reality is we agree on like 97% of the things.
Right. And it's like, we can either get bogged down by debating the things we don't agree on at the cost of the things we do, or we can all agree, like, you know, this stuff here, whether it's kind of usually like immigration and abortion. Okay. We don't all have the same answers for that. But if we leave that behind, then we have more, you know, more attention and more time to devote to the things we do agree on, and we could actually make headway on those things. And I almost feel like if you make headway on those things, the other two become less of an issue, because if you have a decentralized society, then they'll take decentralized approaches to abortion and to immigration, which I think ultimately is the libertarian answer to both of those problems.
Yeah, I completely agree. And focusing on economics, right? Like, I think that economics are it's a very big factor as to why women are aborting children. And, you know, I think that abortion is murder. I just wonder if the current way that conservatives argue, you know, combating it is the proper way to go about it. And rather than, you know, getting into that debate, I think that we can have, like, you know, entrepreneurial candidates or messengers out there making those arguments as to how we could fix this issue. And I just don't think that like a little paragraph on a website can make headway when this is such a contentious issue.
Yeah, I agree. And if people are going to talk about it at all, it's better for the candidates to do it, I think, because they can sort of like, you know, play both sides, I guess, where they can say, well, here are my personal views, but here's the party's view, and the party doesn't really take a stance. And so that allows, you know, people to freely express themselves. It's not like they're being forced to either, you know, right now it's like you're forced to either contradict the party platform, or you're forced to like dodge it or try to ignore it, I guess, if someone brings it up. So it's problematic in that regard, I think. So it's good to remove it. And I think, you know, that I agree, like in my experience, it is, for better or for worse, an issue that conservatives and Christians focus so much on that getting them to consider alternatives to the Republican Party is tough when there's no other party that is at least not pro-choice. It's one thing to say, hey, can you leave the abortion issue aside to focus on other things? But it's hard to do that when you're, you know, joining a party that is basically explicitly pro-choice, at least being neutral, you know, you're not going to get everybody. Because again, I do think there are some who, like, the issue is so important to them, and their view is that, like, you know, we need to use the political system to solve it. And so they're going to continue to operate within the GOP and be single issue voters and whatever. Those are not going to be the people we reach. But the other ones who are more like us, who care about it, but think that the solution is outside of politics, this frees them up to maybe finally make that plunge into the LP without violating their conscience. And, you know, I mean, we need people, obviously. Like, if we're going to be competitive politically, you know, whether it's, I mean, we're honestly, I don't think we'll ever be competitive on a federal level, but we have a chance to be somewhat competitive at a state level in certain states. And I think we have a really unique opportunity to be competitive at the local level. But even there, where the barriers are less, we still need more people. You know what I mean? Like, and the Libertarian Party, I think for so long, has been playing this strategy that's like, instead of growing the movement, it's like, let's try to trick Democrats and Republicans or the moderates into voting for us, even though, like, they don't agree with us on anything. It's like, it's not a winning strategy. It's had, like, you know, certain years where it pays off in the short term and you get like a high vote total, but then you look at the next year and the vote totals drop back down, or at least the percentages drop back down. And it's like, so you're not, you know, getting people to vote Libertarian once doesn't actually move the ball forward in any meaningful capacity.
Yeah, I think Rothbard's idea, like when he helped found the party, is really what we should be pursuing, is that, like, we should be a vehicle for pure libertarianism. And conservatives pretend to be libertarian. And especially in the state here, we hear all the time from both Republicans and Democrats. They're like, well, you know, I have a libertarian streak in me. And I think that, like, if there could actually be a party that represents real libertarianism, we could at least influence them in this state. I know many people who have declared as a libertarian who have then received calls from their Republican candidate, like, trying to negotiate with them and trying to get them to drop out of the race. And I think maybe that's specifically a problem that we have here in Montana, but I think we can really use that to our advantage. And I think that red states like Montana need to, I think we should also maybe embrace decentralization in the Libertarian Party too. And, you know, maybe Montana is one of those states that needs a pro-life platform later. I don't think that I would advocate for that, but, like, and then a more blue state would have a pro-choice one. I just think another problem we ran into here in Montana is some people think that we should have a standardized platform that goes along with the national platform. I don't know if you've ever heard that
argument. I have. Yeah.
Which to me seems weird, because if the national party changes their platform, it's not as if, like, the state party automatically, like, corresponds or fixes. Like, that would have to be voted on.
Not to mention, it's like, it's so contrary to the spirit of libertarianism. Right. It's like individual choice and diversified governance. Oh, but we just copy what national does. Exactly. Like, it's just, it just, it's silly. I guess I'll address the one question we got in the comments. Richard Copeland asked, kind of like, it's an amalgamation of a lot of questions into one statement, but he asked, does the unborn have NAP protection, meaning the non-aggression principle, not babies taking naps, because it's completely different. Do they trump the mother whose choice created the situation, or are they equal, or does the mother have the sole right? I mean, it would take me like an hour. It would take us an hour, a couple hours to answer that, like, thoroughly. I mean, I believe that the unborn, you know, I still view them as an unborn child, as an individual who has the same rights as those who are born. As for, is there, what do you do about the conflict, I guess, between the two beings and whose rights should win out? I mean, I've always kind of said, well, what's the least amount of aggression? And yeah, I guess I understand if I'm going to be charitable to the other side, like, yeah, it's a bit of an ask to, for the mother to, you know, let's say she got pregnant by accident, not intentionally, you know, there's a bit of an ask there to house a fetus for 9 months. But I feel like, you know, the fetus did not put themselves there on purpose. You know what I mean? So it's not like, it's not like they snuck in there or they forced themselves in there. They find themselves in that position. And it's sort of like if you caught a stowaway on your plane while you were, you know, 1,000 miles above the surface. And it's like, okay, well, you have a right to remove them from your plane if you don't want them there, but you kind of have to wait till you're in a position where the removal doesn't immediately result in their, like, in their death. Cause then you're actually violating their rights more than they were violating yours. That's the way I explain it. I don't know if you would, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I agree. And also as technology gets better, like, I don't think it becomes, it's not as strong of a problem. I think that we might be able to save the baby earlier on and
yeah.
We avoid that problem entirely. But I will say, like, you had made a point about like criminal justice and trying to work on the issue outside of politics. And I do wonder if there is an argument that maybe there is kind of like retribution to be had in a criminal system like we have. And I've debated this so much just in my own head, like whether or not it would be a more pacifistic thing in the free market, whether or not we would try to avoid violence at all. I know Bob Murphy kind of has that view of criminal justice, that like incentives move away from violence altogether. And then there's another part of me that sees Rothbard and the idea of like retribution being very important to uphold property rights. And I really don't even know. And I think that that's kind of why I didn't want to have this conversation or like an official stance in the party, because like I would have people come up to me and they're like, I believe that abortion is murder, but I also don't know how you handle this because the mother is the baby's strongest defender. She is the one who would bring a suit against someone. And it's like, how does she bring it against herself if she's the one who chose this? And it's like, does the state, it just feels so weird to me. And I don't know what the answer to that is really either.
Well, I typically reject the state on any level, although there is something to be said that the more local the government, the less problematic it is. But I tend to reject the state being a solution to abortion on any level, because I just ask, like, okay, well, how would you enforce it? Because, again, laws have no meaning if it's just words on paper. Like, you have to enforce that law. So what does that, you know, what shape or form does that take if you pass that law? Are we going to, you know, lock pregnant women in facilities if they even think about or attempt an abortion and hold them there for 9 months? Okay, well, now we're, you know, that seems to me to be a little bit of a moral hazard, to say the least. And then this also, you know, as someone who, so our fourth kid is on the way, but, you know, we've had two miscarriages. Like, so are miscarriages now fair game for the government, for police and law enforcement to investigate? As you know, every miscarriage is now an opportunity for, you know, potential criminal charges to be levied. It just seems to me that you're opening up a lot of issues there. I just think, and now there's something to be said, all right, well, what if we got rid of the state and we had actual, you know, polycentric market governance and anarchistic society? Could there be retributions of a sort applied there? I don't know. I feel like it's always better to aim them at those who provide the service than at the mothers themselves. It's kind of the way I lean. But, you know, this is one of those issues where there's no perfect answer. I do think what you said earlier is spot on, that, and I've had this conversation with Carrie Baldwin, who I think is like the best resource for Christian libertarians to go to as far as like dealing with this issue, because she handles it so well. And she actually had a debate with Walter Block at the Soho Forum, which was really well done. But the reason for most abortions is economic considerations, and then behind that, it's usually being pressured by the family of either the, you know, their own family or the father or et cetera, often for like economic or social reasons. So the more we can do, especially as Christians, right, especially like the church, I think should take a leading role in this, but the more we can do to provide a safe haven and a support system for mothers, for women who have a crisis pregnancy, the more we can actually see a meaningful decrease in abortion. Plus technology plays a role as well. I agree with you there. So that's, you know, it's kind of a difficult balancing act, right? Like we all want to see less abortions, but I'm not a single issue I'm a voter or whatever when it comes to abortion, though. Like I recognize it as the evil it is. I feel like, you know, there are other considerations that have to be made. And I think it's fallacious thinking to base all of your political decisions to based upon, is this person pro-life or pro-choice? But I definitely think it's a lot easier and preferable if the party is at least agnostic on the issue and not taking a pro-choice stance.
Yeah. I mean, I could see them like acknowledging that the unborn, like they are lives and that they have rights and they deserve protections or something like that. But once you start to get into the nuances, I'm not sure. And I think the market would solve that. And I do think that if we are to go the retribution angle, I think, the idea that you would go after the person who administered it is probably the best, option. But then I don't know what happens then with the coat hanger examples.
Yeah, but you know, it's like, again, it's sort of like my response to that is like, there's no, you know, this is kind of like what I label the Nirvana fallacy, which is kind of like, there is no perfect answer, right? There's always going to be a trade-off. There's always going to be a cost. There's always going to be a risk. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't weigh those risks, but like, we're always going to get down to a what if, and we can't eliminate all of the what ifs. I would rather it be harder to get an abortion, and if people get one, that they're taking that risk and doing it that way, than having it be normalized in a doctor's office. It's kind of where that might sound cold to some people, and I'm not saying I want the woman to do a coat hanger abortion, like I don't, but it's like, again, compared to the alternative, it's like I would rather it be denormalized to an extent where people, like, if someone really wanted to do it, they would have to do it that way, versus having it be widely available in various medical facilities.
Yeah, I guess the problem with conversations like this in total is, like, it seems to me the polycentric idea of law is that you would have very decentralized judges deciding based off of the particulars, and it's really hard to come up with general, you know, solutions without having those particulars, and then having the aggregate from a decentralized system. That, because I think then once you would have a decentralized system that does kind of work more like common law, you might be able to pull a precedent or a standard or a rule out of that. But we don't have anything like that right now, I don't think.
Yeah. And then, you know, I guess like the other thing is sort of like, God, I lost my train of thought. When dealing with the issue of abortion, and you know, we're talking to other Christians about this issue, it's sort of like, are you going to be able to convince the entire world to ban abortion, whether that's done through the state or whether that's done through anarchy or whatever? Like, and I don't know, I have this problem with Christians broadly speaking, not even just on abortion, but it's just like, I don't know, like part of me is just, I guess I've accepted that there are always going to be those who are not Christian and people who are going to find some corner of this planet to live lifestyles and to participate in things that I find to be degenerate or evil. And I don't think that what Christ calls us to do is to seek those people out and to wield the sword against them to stop them. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like I'm not a pacifist. Like, I believe in bearing the sword to protect the innocent. But again, that's where abortion becomes this tricky thing, right? Because it's like, well, if you believe in protecting the innocent, then you believe in protecting the unborn child. And then it's just like endless loops. Like, I get where Christians are coming from when they want to wield the state to protect the unborn. But it's just like, I don't know. I feel like we get better return on our results when we use different, you know, so it's a kind of a utilitarian argument, I guess, is what I'm making. Like, I want to see abortions end. The best ways to decrease abortion seem to be all these other things that we can do in the market and not the state. So that's sort of where I come down. If I could be shown the contrary, if I could be shown that the state was very effective at banning abortion, maybe. But then even then, it's like, well, if you ban it at the federal level, they can unban it then just as easily, right? So it's like, I don't know, it kind of seems like a waste of time. If you're going to ban it anywhere, ban it in your local community, I guess. That seems to be the way that I would go. But then there's also, like, you know, maybe we could steer the topic in this direction, because I'm curious for your thoughts on this kind of more broadly speaking and not just abortion. But, like, it seems to me that, like, Christians can sometimes get caught up in, like, trying to eliminate sin, like, in every aspect of society, which, I mean, I'm not saying I want to encourage sin, but I feel like there's some extent to which, like, you know, we can look through history and see that, like, there have been Christians who have tried this before. They've tried to use the state to punish sinful lifestyles and to enforce a sort of Christian morality. And it just doesn't seem to me that that is a winning strategy or a Christ-like strategy. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah, well, I think it's also just like we have to kind of look to the cross and the idea that we've already been saved. And I think that, like, the idea of defeating sin, I think we need to humble ourselves there, because, like, Jesus has already defeated sin. And I think that our role is to point people towards the cross. And, you know, people who have, maybe people who have had an abortion or who are going through with an abortion or who are about to, like, our role then is to point them to the cross and explain to them what happened there and the salvation that comes from that and you know, the defeat of death and what the significance of forgiveness is. Because I think that the way that we actually do defeat sin, I think, in the long term, is trying, like, if we are to address these issues is to point people to the miracle that is forgiveness and what happened on the cross. I don't think that we can prevent people from committing atrocities or anything like that. I mean, Christ himself was killed. And yeah, I think that, that is what makes that story so beautiful.
I agree. Do you think part of the motivation is that people are just afraid of the persecution and afraid of, like, they're not, and I want to be careful here. Like, I'm not saying I'm, like, you know, joyful about going to be persecuted or joyful about, like, the idea that I could be, you know, killed for standing for my beliefs. But I don't think that just because I would prefer those things not to happen. I still think that it's not the Christian response to, in the face of that, then be like, well, it's kill or be killed, right? Like, it seems very contrary to everything Jesus said, which was, like, kind of the opposite. Like, you've heard me say, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But now I tell you, you know, if your enemy slaps you, you know, strikes you in the face, to turn your other cheek. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. There's something there that, I don't know, that I've been struggling with, because that's kind of my baseline. And then I see some of the things in our culture, like with this, like, you know, the trans stuff and the public schools and whatnot. And then I'm a bit more, I guess, triggered on that stuff to be like, well, no, I'm not going to let people do that, you know, indoctrinate kids that way. But I don't know. It's like, do you feel like, I feel like half the struggle here with, like, all libertarianism is, like, line drawing. It's like, yeah, we don't know where to put these lines of, like, you know, we'll act in these circumstances, but not in these ones.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, I tend to think that it would just be the role of the church and the community to kind of, like, create an example. And I think that that's kind of what we get at with decentralization, is kind of creating safe havens. And the one in history that I always point to is, like, Wisconsin being a sanctuary for the slaves, right? I think that, like, if we kind of had that perspective on the church too, that, like, we are these kind of beacons for salvation, forgiveness, and everything like that, we can do a lot more than we could if we tried to wield, you know, a centralized power. I think the concept of power, especially right now in the conversations we see on Twitter about the state and weaponizing it against sin, is that power is talked about too unidimensionally. Like, we treat power as if it really is like a strong president, a strong executive, or like DeSantis or something like that. But I think the strong people throughout history are those like Bonhoeffer, who was kind of made fun of in Reed's tweet the other day, who, you know, he fled the United States after founding the Confessing Church, and then decided that he didn't want to betray his people. And he went back and ended up, like, plotting assassinations against Hitler and trying to organize the church. And he's a very controversial figure, but I feel like, power is almost seen through being, like, I think it might be tied up in, like, manhood and conversations there too. Like, we don't think a strong man is, like, someone who goes around bullying people. We think a strong man is someone who sets an example and who has people following them because they're leading and stuff like that. And I think the kind of part of the problem we have right now in these conversations is just that we do have a very simple concept of power that I think is caught up in very high time preference behavior too. The idea that using a sword will accomplish things in the long term, I don't think that there's really any proof of that. I think that it's actually changing people's hearts that really affects, yeah, change over time.
When, and having faith, I think, is part of this too. Like, it, I like, some people, I think, confuse me for being a pacifist, which I have a camaraderie with pacifists, but I wouldn't say I'm as, what's the word here? Like, purely opposed to all aggression and violence like a pacifist would be. I definitely lean that way. And I think that's just because I try to read the Bible and just take what it says at face value. Like there's, you know, especially when it comes to the life that Jesus led, it's kind of, there's very few examples of him being aggressive at all. And usually when he was being aggressive, he was rebuking religious people, oddly enough. but one of the passages, I was actually talking about this on Twitter the other day, where Peter cuts off the ear of the high priest and Jesus rebukes him, but he doesn't rebuke him. Like sometimes pacifists are like, oh, see, Jesus is saying, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Violence is bad. And I'm like, yeah, I feel like that's an oversimplistic reading of the passage. I think what Jesus is getting at is the error Peter is making is actually like Peter's compounding the same error over the entirety of like that, like 24-hour period where Jesus is taken and then crucified. He's struggling with his faith, right? Like he's not trusting in what Jesus has said, because Jesus has literally like, it's not like they were caught off guard by this. Jesus literally, I don't know how many times, you know, at least 3 or 4, if not more, had told them like, I'm going to be betrayed, I'm going to be killed, and in 3 days I am going to rise. And it's like, but Peter was not trusting in what Jesus said was going to happen and unfold. Instead, he's taking matters in his own hands and trying to, the problem wasn't Peter using violence. The problem was Peter trying to use violence to control everything around him. And that was Peter's error. And I think that is what Christians are still struggling with today. It's like, it's not our role to, I mean, this is what it says in Romans 12, right? You know, God is the one who takes vengeance. That's not for us. You know, God, and really God has already overcome evil. And I think you have it exactly right, Liam. Like, we're just supposed to, like, our job is simple. We're just supposed to go out there and just preach the gospel, just point people to the cross and what Jesus has done, and then leave it up to the Holy Spirit to convict people, and leave it up to God, who, you know, God's the only one that's sovereign over you know, creation to the extent that he can control anything. And our attempts are just pitiful and really a waste in comparison to that.
Yeah, I really like that idea that Peter's kind of acting out of fear and he's wanting to control the environment. Like he has fear of the world rather than fear of God and trust in God. And I think that's an interesting concept there. And I think it draws back to the verse, like, consider the lilies, how they grow. I think that I really like that analysis, but I do still struggle with like these concepts of power and using the sword against evil people too. And it's one of those things where I just, you know, I try to sit on these things and I don't think I ever come to a definitive answer. Like, even the idea of like Bonhoeffer trying to assassinate Hitler or something like that I probably would, but there's a part of me that like still thinks it's really hard to come to an idea there
or come to a position there. I agree. It's like, I feel like I would want to, but then it's like, and I think part of the problem here, you know, God, that's a meta thing. I just said part of the problem and I'm about to cite Dave Smith. but part of the problem here is that like, it's exactly what Dave said, means become ends. So like, if you decide that like the way that you are going to combat evil is to like, you know, we're going to take violence and overthrow the evil people, it's like, how are you? And Jordan Peterson is like just such a brain busting red pill on this stuff. He's like, you're wrong to think that if you were in Nazi Germany that you wouldn't be one of the ones, you know, helping to round up the Jews or outing your Jewish neighbors. Like, the truth is, statistically speaking, you're much more likely to be the, you know, it's only like one in a million who was like a Schindler or someone else who would actually boldly defy the totalitarianism. And So insofar as that is true, it's like people who think that they could just take power and use violent means to overthrow evil and not end up just becoming the next oppressors. Like they're really just lacking the self-awareness of like their own depravity, which is something that you think Christians should be especially like knowledgeful of, is the depravity of, and so that kind of, you know, that's one of the classic responses to people who were like, you know, anarchy is dumb because people are evil. It's like, no, like, you know, as a Christian, I know people are evil, and it's because people are evil that giving them power is a really bad strategy. And if people are, and you can't eliminate power, but, you know, power and authority should go to those who don't seek it through violence, but rather like they earn it through getting pushed up to that hierarchy through their modeling that archetype of being a leader, which is what Jesus taught, right? Like he said, if any of you would be a leader and would be first among you, he must be last. And, you know, to be a leader is to be a servant. And that's what he modeled. I mean, you know, it's, I don't know. It just, to me, that it just seems like it's right there. Like, this is how the church is supposed to live. This is what we're supposed to do. And it's really disheartening to see so many Christians missing the mark. And believe me, I get it. Like, when you're in the faith, when you look the left right now in the eye and you see some of the really evil crap they're promoting, I'm not saying it doesn't invoke in me that same sort of response that I think some of the people are having that's behind this sort of like drive to like, well, we need to wield power against them. But it's just, we have to learn from history. Like, at some point we have to look back and see what has been tried and see that it doesn't work and realize that, like, you know, the only thing that has ever worked is really, I think, what Jesus modeled.
Yeah. And I mean, like, even for libertarians, we were talking specifically about Christians right there, not really understanding this, but libertarians, you know, there is the concept of the power vacuum, and like, to kind of appeal to what happens if we use force or like try to remove like Assad from power or something like that. Like, we will grant he's a tyrant, or if we try to remove like Putin from power, like, what would fill that void? I think we're kind of conservative in that way, that we don't want things to change that quickly. And I think the way we want things to work is very decentralized and locally, because if we do try to like destroy the whole thing from the top down, I think that might create more disorder. I'm not sure there, but yeah,
I mean, it's like Jordan Peterson says, most new ideas are stupid.
Yeah.
That's why conservatism is such a bulwark against chaos, because it's like you're just, you know, better off being highly resistant to new ideas and scrutinizing them. And if you scrutinize the new ideas with that sort of conservative skepticism, then only the really, really good ideas that can overcome all your objections are the ones that, you know, you slowly incorporate into your old system, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering what you think about this idea. I've been thinking about it a lot, that such a controversial issue, but like I see that there's a comment about, if there is no God, where do John McCain and Madeleine Albright go when they die? I wonder what you think about the idea that, like, if we saw them in heaven, that would be like a miracle. So I think that, like, people like Reed, when they hear that, they might be like, well, that means that God is evil. If
right, you just put Reed back into the atheist camp firmly again.
Yes. So it's like, I don't. What do you think about that? Like, if we died and we found Hitler or John McCain in heaven,
right?
What would that say?
Gosh, this is kind of like
problem.
What? Right. Well, this is the problem of forgiveness that you kind of cited earlier, and it's sort of Christianity's greatest attribute, but also its greatest weakness, because, like, on one hand, I mean, it's amazing to think that there's nothing we could do that can separate us from the goodness and the mercy and the love of God. But then it's like, we can, as libertarians especially, look at some of these people like McCain and be like, oh, look at all the evil shit he did. Like, you know, even him, God, you can love even him and forgive even him. And I don't know. I do think the Christian hat has to win out at the end of the day. You know, we don't earn our forgiveness. And I think the problem is that John McCain is evil, but I guess the way I look at it is I'm also evil. And if I had grown up in John McCain's environment and lived his set of experiences, again, kind of like the thing I said earlier, where like you're statistically likely to have been the person rounding up the Jews in Nazi Germany, I think a lot of us are statistically likely to be the John McCains and the George Bushes and the Barack Obamas. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we would all be that bad, but it's like when your best argument is like, oh, well, if I was in those positions, I might not have killed as many people. It's kind of like the people who simp for Trump and they're like, oh, well, he didn't start any new wars. It's like, that's not good enough. You know what I mean? But that's the point. Like the forgiveness is that the point of the cross is exactly that, which is that all fall short of the glory of God. And, you know, who am I to say that, you know, if God can, you know, if God forgives me, who am I to go to him and say, but you can't forgive that person? I didn't earn my forgiveness any more than that person did. If God forgives them, we can't demand the forgiveness, but we also can't demand that God be selective with the forgiveness either. And that is a major, you know, that might be one of the harder parts of Christian theology to swallow, I admit. Like, you know, I don't think Hitler or, you know, John McCain are in heaven, but I mean, can I bank that? Can I take that to the bank with 100% certainty? No, any more than I can make sure. There's no way for me to know that I'll be in heaven. I mean, Bible says work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And, you know, I wouldn't bet on those people being in heaven. I'm not saying that's a high likelihood, but it's just, you know, this stuff's complicated. And I think you have to approach it with a sense of humility I know I'm going on a bit of a rant here, but like, this isn't even strictly biblical stuff. Like, this is what science has taught us. This is what psychology has taught us. Like, when Jordan Peterson talks about like how you would be likely to be rounding up the Jews in Nazi Germany, he's not citing the Bible. He's citing his decades of experience within the field of psychology and studying the 20th century and how these horrors were committed. And that's the conclusion he came to. And I think it lines up with the Bible, but we can derive that knowledge just by looking at the empirical reality around us.
Right. I mean, it's like even in today's environment, the amount of people who probably support going to war with Russia right now.
Yeah.
You know, evil, I feel like sometimes might even represent itself through just naive people and manipulation. Like, and I don't think that's speaking to them themselves. I think that that's more about the sin than the sinner. And I think that that's kind of where I think that's the solution here, is that you really do have to separate the sin from the sinner. And the idea that they're really being manipulated and led here. It's like if John McCain were to be in heaven, or if Hitler were to be in heaven at the end, I would hope not to pause and be like, oh, well, he is such an evil person that he deserves damnation. I would see in that moment that there must have been such a significant transformation that person is no longer, he has been transformed. It's not even, we're not even speaking about the same being at this point.
Well, yeah. And honestly, like, I mean, another thing we know through psychology, I think, is just that like, a lot of the people who have done the most evil things have been like, they were twisted up by a lot of evil around them. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, here's a question. Like, would you go back and kill baby Hitler? And I sometimes surprise people when I say like, no, I wouldn't. Because at that point he's innocent. Like, he's completely, he's just a baby. And, you know, I think it's helpful to always, the way that God looks at us, it's like, imagine if you were, like, imagine if someone came from the future right now and, like, said, Liam, your son's going to grow up and commit the next Holocaust. Would that make you love your son less? Like, think about that. Like, that's really what this is about. Like, if God loves us because we're his children, but yet at the same time, he knows his child will go on to commit great atrocities. It's like, well, if you knew that about your child, would you suddenly not love your child? Like, that, you know, so listen, I'm not saying this stuff's easy. Like, this is some of the meat and potatoes of religion, but I, that's the way I think we have to try to view it. And God is, you know, as much as he's a God of justice and of goodness and he abhors evil, you know, he's also a God of love and of mercy. And it's only through that acknowledgement that, you know, we don't earn our salvation. I think that the true beauty of what the cross is really comes into focus. Because the minute you can compare yourself to somebody else and say, I deserve to be here, but they don't, you've missed the point. Because that's not what the point of the cross was. The point wasn't, it wasn't that we could get our, you know, I forget where I heard this, but it's the idea that, like, religion for most of history was about how to get to the top of the mountain and get to God. But what Jesus did was say, no, like, you will not make it on your own. Instead, I will come down and we'll go up the mountain together. That is what Christianity is about. So that does. Okay. Well, yeah, I might kill Woodrow Wilson. We'll make an exception there, Brady. But no, even then, it's like, I mean, now listen, would I kidnap Woodrow Wilson and try to raise him better? Like, you know, I'm not saying if I had time travel, I wouldn't maybe try to abuse it, but I wouldn't kill someone who's innocent, who hasn't committed those crimes yet. And I think we have to be humble in recognizing that seed of human evil that's within all of us.
Yeah, I'd try to go back in history and sit on the admissions for art school and try to get Hitler into art school instead.
Right, yeah.
I wonder, have you seen the video of, do you remember the Amber... Oh, I think I cut out again. Sorry about that.
You keep, like, every time you go to speak, you have, like, a second cutout, and then it comes back. So
it's terrible. No, have you seen the Amber Geiger case, or do you remember following that at all?
Maybe I have, but I don't know.
Yeah, she was the police officer who, she got off of work, went home, and then entered the wrong apartment.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So her trial, the guy's brother, the guy who she killed, his brother sat in the trial and essentially forgave her and asked for a hug. And this is one of the most moving scenes I've ever watched. And this is what I typically reference to make the point that you just made about forgiveness. It's like, I think that what Botham Jean is his name. He's the guy who forgave Amber. What he did will do more long-term than I think the criminal justice system will. I mean, she's like bawling her eyes out and he's like, you know, my brother loved Christ and he would want you to turn to Christ. And I forgive you. And I know he would want me to forgive you. And I think that really is like Christ is kind of, I mean, he's in that moment right there. And I think, my pastor describes kind of what happens on the cross and the type of love that occurs on the cross is like one that sacrifices one's own dignity and bestows it on another. Mm. And I think that what's so beautiful about the story of Christ is it's not like the story of a family member forgiving someone who, you know, murdered their son or something like that. Like it's about Christ forgiving everyone when everyone and their sins are responsible for his own death.
Right.
And there's something so significant and profound there that I can't even, there's so many layers to it. And I think that you're right that Jordan Peterson is very good at picking apart what exactly is happening there on the cross. And there's just so many layers to forgiveness and love there that I think needs to be focused on a lot more by Christians.
And I think, you know, libertarians can learn from that. And I mean, obviously I would hope that everyone comes to Christ and would accept what he did for them on a personal level. But you can even just like look at this from a practical level and the utility of forgiveness, right? Because like, imagine if after World War One, the Western powers took a reconciliatory approach to Germany instead of the punitive one. Like, imagine just how differently history plays out if they forgave Germany instead of seeking vengeance upon them. And that is the utility of forgiveness. It's the wisdom in it. And that's why, like, you know, violence begets violence. You know, it's true, like an eye for an eye and the whole world goes blind. Like these aren't just truisms, and they might be cliches, but like, you know, cliches are sometimes like, you know, they're called cliches not because they're false. It's just like they're so true that like to utter them can sometimes be embarrassing because it's like you've heard them so much, but they're still true. And that doesn't mean that, you know, I would say forgiveness should not mean injustice. Like if somebody is going around, you know, murdering people, well, like, you know, forgive them, but, you know, also like, stop them from continuing to murder people. You know, defense is not in conflict with forgiveness. You know, I would say if you steal from somebody, you know, that person that was stolen from, you know, restitution should be made and encouraged. But there's a difference between sort of like the legal remedies that we would still need for a society to function, which I think, by the way, that's the actual message of Romans 13, not the justification of a state, but rather like, you know, Romans 12 and 13 are right next to each other. So in Romans 12, Paul is saying, like, live at peace with all and do not overcome evil with evil. Do not seek vengeance. He's like, but, you know, administer civil justice. And if people are, you know, there are people who need to wield the sword in the defense of the innocent. Like anyway, that's a whole different thing. But, you know, insofar as, you know, yes, if people are going around hurting people and if people are, you know, if their rights are being violated, there needs to be legal remedies to that. The legal remedies should be to make the victim whole and less about applying punitive measures on the person who did the perpetrating. And really, I think criminal justice should be less about punishing people and more about trying, you know, more of a restorative, regenerative approach where you're trying to identify why people had, why that person did what they did and to put them on the path to healing and ultimately, if possible, being reintegrated into society. Like that's what we should want as libertarians and as Christians, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot that Christian or that libertarian can learn from Christianity, and I really appreciated your podcast with David Smith the other day and the concept of truth that came up, and the idea that like Jesus is truth, God is truth, and that like so long as we tell the truth, it will lead us closer to, I think, freedom and to God. I mean, like something that keeps coming up. We had Scott Horton talk at the University of Montana here, and at the end, he's like, you know, we're kind of at this point where there's really no one representing the truth. There's no like, there's even Rand Paul is pretty weak on this, and he's like, so what we have to do is we just have to go out there and speak the truth like Rand Paul told us to do. And, you know, Ron Paul was a Christian, and I think a lot of what was moving him was Christian ideals. And then there's also the concept of, like, I know Dave was kind of repurposing what Ron Paul said, that, like, no revolution, not born out of love, or what's the phrase? It's like a revolution not born out of love will end tyranny, or something like that.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I think that that's also exactly kind of Christian ethic. And I think you really have to define love there, in order for that to be true. And I think that what we're talking about is exactly that, kind of speaking truth and then also having that kind of delicate balance between, forgiveness, mercy, retribution, and justice.
Yeah, I agree. By the way, you have kind of gone to that Matrix thing again.
Okay.
I wasn't able to hear everything you said, but you might want to try leaving and coming back in one more time while we wrap this up. By the way, H. Reardon, I saw your comment. What about the message of Matthew 10:34? I actually just talked about this on Twitter the other day, but to read the passage quick, just to fill the time while Liam's coming in and out. So it reads, "Do not think I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household. And whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." So H. Reardon, what Jesus is getting there is that, and actually this fits perfectly with what Liam was just talking about, which is that our goal, like our end goal, is actually peace. But you do not get to peace by appeasing people, and you don't get to peace by avoiding the truth. And what Jesus is getting at in this passage is that he is coming to stir things up. And so, you know, and what he's getting at is that, you know, and this is what happens. Like, there's going to be strifes among people because of the radical nature of his message. And listen, as libertarians, 100%, that's what we do. I mean, look at the Giuliani moment with Ron Paul. Like, Ron is an advocate of peace, but when Ron was going into these battles in the Republican Party, he kind of was going in sort of with a sword, wasn't he? Like, you know, I mean, he was being gentle in his own way, but his message, his boldness in proclaiming the truth, even when it was unpopular, even when it caused strifes with, you know, with people. And then a lot of us have experienced that. Like, when we start preaching the truth, we might lose some friends. We might even have family that feel like they can't support us, or that they don't agree with us, and they'll, you know, block you on social media or fight with you or whatever. Like, you know, this is the kind of stuff that Jesus did in his day. And just, you know, in the same way that, like, Dave Smith and Scott Horton and all of us, you know, I think in this kind of Mises Caucus sphere, what we're trying to do is to in order to have long-term peace, we cannot have and avoid, we cannot sacrifice the current status quo of, like, a sort of like faux peace, where it's like a peace that's built upon of avoidance, and a peace that's built upon, like, suppression of the truth and people avoiding the problems. It's sort of like the way that we're avoiding a recession right now is not actually by dealing with the economic reality. We just keep on spending money and keep on doing qualitative easing and keep on artificially keeping interest rates as low as possible. Like, we're avoiding right now that economic disaster, but it's still coming. And so in the same way, that's what Jesus was saying in that passage. And it so perfectly lines up with what Liam just brought up, which is that, like, you know, this revolution that we're part of is built on love. And if you love your neighbor, you owe it to them to tell them the truth, because, you know, the truth is what sets you free. And that's true whether we're talking about geopolitical events, if we're talking about economics or whether it's about the nature of reality and, you know, facing the deepest, darkest parts of your being in nature and realizing your need for a savior. Like, those are all things where the truth can be uncomfortable, but it is what leads to ultimate peace and freedom.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. And I think that, like, really to emphasize the truth aspect there, it's like we're living in a false reality right now. And I think that, like, returning back to truth can be painful, as we will see with the recessions. And once we start, or once we stop printing money, I think that, like, the return to reality will be very painful. But while we're living in this, you know, kind of castle in the sky, like, I think that what ends up happening is that people become, or people get, they're deceived. And then once we start to turn towards truth, they will turn on people who represent the truth. I think COVID's like a perfect example of this. And it's like in Mark 13, I think verse 12, it says, like, you know, family will turn on family. Like, people will send their family members to death. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing right now. And I think that truth and God as truth will have to come to restore that to order, I guess.
Yeah. And when he says, like, you have to love me more than your own family, like, some people take that very harshly. But what God's saying is that, like, if you don't, because, like, you know, Jesus is the truth. You know what I mean? It's like, and if you don't put God, you don't put the truth, if you don't put what is good at the top, you know, it's sort of like your hierarchy of values has to be properly oriented, or it's sort of like doing your math wrong when you're doing an equation, when you're going to, like, send a spaceship or a satellite up to, like, the moon or to Mars or something. Like, you know, a little error in your math now, you might not notice that you're off course when it's leaving Earth's atmosphere, but when, instead of landing on Mars, it's, like, you know, halfway on its way to Venus, it's like, oh crap, I guess I did my math wrong. And in that same way, when we, you know, when we are not putting God at that top, if we're not putting Jesus at the top, if our worship isn't oriented around the truth of what God has done for us, we will be led astray. I just lost Liam. Oh, now he's back. StreamYard is all sorts of glitchy tonight, man. Or it's your Wi-Fi. I don't know.
Yeah, you cut out for me there. And
you cut out for me. I don't know. Who knows? but yeah, no. And it's, you know, it's funny how, like, H. Reardon brought that passage up so randomly, because it, like, so perfectly fits what we're talking about. You know, it's the kind of things, like, I don't know what your experience is, man, but, like, there's so many, like, little things like that happen in my life where it's just, like, I don't know, like, it's sort of like, you know, you're on the right path because, like, weird circumstances sort of line up that way in ways that, like, you weren't expecting, like, whether it's, like, meeting a person at the right point in time or somebody says something in sort of, like, the perfect setting to inspire, you know, productive conversation or to solve a problem. You know, it's like some people want evidence for God in a sort of, like, I don't know, sort of, like, scientific sense. And I'm just like, I believe in God just because, like, I don't know. It's just there comes a point where it's like, you know, I either have to believe in God or I have to believe in the God of just, like, never ending coincidences.
Right. Yeah. It usually happens for me with, like, sermons. I'll be talking with someone about some issue. Like I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, like, as an example, if the next sermon was about abortion after having this conversation.
Yeah.
Like, things like that happen all the time. And, an example, this happened last weekend. There's this hymn that I really love. It's what's it called? It's called We Love and Acknowledge You, O Lord. And it's, Gustav Holst's, his Jupiter. That's what it's based off of. And I had been mentioning that and talking to people about it the week before. And then all of a sudden it comes up in service, the following Sunday. And it's like coincidences like that happen all the time. And that's evidence of God for me.
Yeah. I remember I had been really discouraged by the church's, like both my personal church and like in general, the church's response to lockdowns. And I basically went from being like, you know, someone who went every Sunday and was a leader on the worship team to like, I didn't go for like the better part of like a year. And then I kind of realized like, okay, well, I'm not happy with what the church is doing, but like if I remove myself from it, you know, maybe I'm supposed to be part of the solution, you know, or people like, you know, at the very least, I should be obedient to God even when other people aren't being. So the first Sunday that I went back, I go and the pastor gives a sermon that is basically about he speaks out of the book of Judges, and it was like they were finishing a series in the book of Judges. And then I was like rolling my eyes because he was going on about the, you know, the refrain that's like, and there was no king in the land of Israel and everyone did was right in their own eyes. And, you know, I was just like, oh, great, you know, and, you know, I'm sure we're going to hear Romans 13 and blah, 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 blah. And then suddenly it goes completely different. Then he says, but then we see later in 1 Samuel 8 that when they get a king, it's not a solution to their problems, and that the only true king is God. And you know, we have to stop looking to political figures to be our saviors. And I was like, holy crap. Like, like I've been gone for a year, and then I come back and the first Sunday I'm back, like my pastor's giving a sermon that might as well have been titled No King But Christ. And I was just like blown away by that. And it's just, you know, there's so many things like that happen that just, I mean, they're just like, it can be hard to communicate the, just like the awe that fills you when those things happen, and that continue to happen. So yeah, it's, I know exactly what you mean when it's like sermons or conversations, or you know, you turn the radio on at the right moment and a song comes on that speaks to you. It's just, it's you know, that's how God works, and that's how he talks to us, and that's how he guides us.
Yeah, my pastor, he said something pretty similar. He's been really good on this. He was the first church in my county to open back up, and he's told me personally like he won't shut down again. And really, we've kind of been, especially in the Bible studies, been prioritizing the relationship of the church to the state. And he actually is the one who taught me about Bonhoeffer and he kind of like the different spheres of authority. And we learned about the Magdeburg Confession. Do you know anything about the Magdeburg Confession?
I might have heard it, but I don't know it by name.
Yeah, I would love to see you look into it and maybe do an episode on it. It's very interesting because it was a bunch of church figures that came together to try to, they were protesting against the Roman Empire. I could be wrong about that. And they developed the concept of the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, which is essentially just localism. And the idea is when a higher authority gets out of line with God's word, a lower authority can kind of put it in its place.
Huh, that's cool. I just looked it up here.
Yeah.
Huh. And it looks like, yeah, I'll have to do an episode on that. That fits a lot. That sort of fits into, it sort of fits a little bit into the Dutch Reformed idea of severe sovereignty a little bit.
Yeah.
There's probably a little bit of overlap there. So that's cool. Well, we're about an hour and a half in. I don't go for, you know, 2.5 hours like Reed does when we go on his show, at least not very often. But this was a great conversation, man. I appreciate you coming on, and you know, this is the kind of stuff that I think we need to be talking about. And so I hope people are encouraged by these conversations, and you know, they can just be a small part of, you know, the ongoing pursuit of, you know, trying to find the truth and find meaning in all of this, and you know, being encouraged to go out there and, you know, keep, we all have our own battles to fight, you know what I mean? And it all comes together to, I think, the glory of God and to the you know, being part of that overcoming of evil through good. So where any closing thoughts, and then you know, where can people find you if they want to, you know, follow you and what you're doing?
Yeah, everyone can find my YouTube channel at Liam McCullum, and then my Twitter account is @MLiamMcCullum. I'm also on Odyssey, Spotify, and Apple Music, so everyone should follow me there. I just released an episode with Scott Horton. It's a recording of a talk that he gave to my student group on campus here. So it's like 3 hours long, but I mean, it's a real deep dive.
So into pretty short for Scott.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then it was funny. He gave another talk 2 days later at the other college in Montana, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, I'll make this one much shorter because I talked for 3 hours the night before," and he's like, "It went for 2.5 hours." So it's like he just cut 30 minutes off.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah,
that's funny.
I really appreciate you having me on, man. We'll have to do it again, and you'll have to come on my show.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, let's keep the conversation going on your show and mine. So. Well, yeah, thanks again for coming on. Thanks for everybody in the comments too. Like, you know, it's really cool to have that interaction with you in the audience. Even you, H. Reardon, like, I know you and I disagree. Like, you're on all of our shows, and like, you know, you definitely come from a very different perspective of, you know, being more, you know, I know, I see your comment on Reed's show last night. They like, you're a fan of Matt Dillahunty, who's like a very, you know, that the school of skepticism, and that's his brand of atheism. And, you know, listen, I appreciate you coming on the show, even with our disagreements, because, like, you know, you bring questions and a sort of differing point of view, which I like. I don't like being in an echo chamber. So thanks for showing up and always interacting, and the rest of you as well. Even you, David Brady, even though, you know, Your snark is still making me question my peaceful parenting approach, but I don't think you were spanked enough as a kid. No, but yeah, this was great. We'll definitely do it again sometime. So thanks, everybody. And yeah, until next time, don't fear the fire.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.